I'm John Kroll. We have a special No Limits for you today. NPR legend Diane Rehm of The Diane Rehm Show is in Indianapolis to perform in Surviving Grace, a play about coping with Alzheimer's disease. She and Surviving Grace playwright Trish Vredenburg are in the studio with us today. If you want to join the conversation, and I know you will, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI and on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We've got a special show today, and if you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, my guests are Diane Rehm of The Diane Rehm Show. Almost everyone who listens to this station obviously has been listening to her as well. And playwright Trish Vredenburg, who's going to be talking about her play Surviving Grace, which is the reason that Diane and Trish are in town in Indianapolis for a performance tomorrow night at Clues Hall. Welcome both of you to the program.
Thank you.
It's very good to have you here. So I've got to ask about the genesis of the play here. I think we probably ought to talk about that really quickly. Trish, could you talk a little bit about what prompted you to write it? And then you've got a pretty spectacular cast here of local folks, and then folks like Diane and Mary Lou Henners coming in. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I was a writing for Designing Women, a TV show, when I found out my mom had Alzheimer's. At least she was going astray. And so I watched as she devolved down into that, you know, horrific vortex. And I knew nothing about Alzheimer's. This was in the late 80s. And she was a lioness of a woman, a powerful lady, but she was no match for Alzheimer's. And so I watched as she went down. She lost her mind, her memories, her dignity, and ultimately her life, which is a classic case, although they all vary within that parameter. And so I continued writing some sitcoms, but I couldn't let it go. I couldn't let my mom go. And so I do what I do, and that was write. And I wrote a play that went to the Kennedy Center and Off-Broadway. Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem like there were answers out there. We have 5.5 million people with Alzheimer's. And you would never guess it by what Congress is doing, giving money to NIH. So we have to get people activated. The play is one of those. And thank God I found Diane Rehm. Believe me, she doesn't only do radio. She is incredible in this part, which calls for drama, of course, pathos, and just incredible delivery of very sharp lines. She is funny and beyond belief. So that's what we're doing. We're going in different cities now and trying to raise money for research and awareness, because people don't seem to get how big a problem this is. So we want to.
Why is that, do you think? I mean, is it because it scares them?
I think there's more. Well, you know, it's not how they want to be remembered. With HIV/AIDS, they were hiding out too. They were in the closet, and they came out and they said, "Damn it, we have this terrible disease. Mm-hmm. It's going to cost you folks a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so they could march, they could, you know, do lobbying. And now it's within 10 years, it's a manageable disease. Mm-hmm. Oh, to be a manageable disease.
From where it started, yeah.
Well, no, for us, what we give to be a manageable disease. Yeah. And they're still getting $3 billion from mm-hmm. NIH, and we're getting $550 million. Mm-hmm. So we've got to. Unfortunately, our victims cannot talk.
Mm-hmm.
So we are their witnesses
and can't lobby as a result.
And
Diane,
can't
what?
March.
Yeah. Can't march, and you know the and
can't
their caretakers are exhausted.
Yeah.
So we're offering them a chance to take some power back and write to their representatives and do something that will make them feel, the caretakers, that they're doing what they should.
Diane, what drew you to this project?
Well, first meeting Trish and her husband George, who head up this wonderful organization called Us Against Alzheimer's, and they are working all the time to help people understand the importance of recognizing the disease, of helping people realize the importance of it, not only to each of us personally, but to the population as a whole, and how many people are going to suffer with the population over 80 being the fastest growing population mm-hmm. in this country. More and more people will suffer from Alzheimer's disease, and more of us will be called on to take care of them. I got involved through friendship and through love for Trish and George, having read that play and having the honor of being invited to participate in it. It's the thrill of a lifetime.
What part do you play?
I play the mother who falls into Alzheimer's.
You should see her. I mean, she is incredible.
And I've got to add, I mean, there are some performance aspects to doing a show. To doing a show like
yes.
this. But it's not, you know, this is not acting by and large. You ask questions, and you know, when you do your show and all of that. How do you make the transformation? I mean, had you ever thought of being an actress, or how do you come to terms with being a character other than yourself?
You know, years ago, a group in Washington did a great big cocktail party book with women of Washington, photographing them in what they wanted as their dream achievement. And mine was a photograph with an Oscar award.
So you've been a frustrated actress for
years?
I've
been on the stage since I was 5. So doing this play is truly the dream of a lifetime.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Marcia, and if you would like to join the conversation by email, you can do so by sending your email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can call us at 866-476-3881. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Marcia says, "Hello, Diane, and welcome to Indianapolis."
Hi.
If you have not already done so, could you please talk to us a little bit about your personal and family history, relationship with Alzheimer's disease and dementia? She's got a couple of other questions, one of which I'm going to ask you in a little bit, too. But could you talk a little bit about your, if there's any family history?
My family history is that my father came here to this country from Beirut, Lebanon, mm-hmm. in 1907. He became a U.S. citizen. He was drafted toward the end of the First World War mm-hmm. into the U.S. Army and served in France. He went back to the old country, to Alexandria, Egypt, to marry my mother, who was at the time engaged to someone else, brought her here to this country in 1929. I am first generation in this country. I think that the idea of Alzheimer's is very much linked to Parkinson's disease, which is what my husband died from 6 months ago.
I'm sorry.
It's a brain disorder. Mm-hmm. Thank you, John. I appreciate that. He decided at the end of his life that he could no longer use his hands. He could no longer stand on his own. He could no longer take care of himself. He chose to die by not eating, not drinking, not taking medication. His doctor there at assisted living was there with him, knew exactly what he was doing, supported him throughout, and my husband died after 10 days of self-starvation.
How hard was that to watch?
Very. And, you know, I had to respect my husband's wishes. We had talked about it with each other a great deal long before he became ill. We had both promised each other we would help each other die if it came to that. But I could do absolutely nothing. I had to respect his wishes, which I did.
How did, and if these questions get to be, obviously you've been on the other side of this experience where you're the one who gets to ask the questions, but if any of the questions get too intrusive, please feel free
Thank
to tell
you.
Me so.
Thank you.
But I would think, as a married man myself, that would be a very difficult conversation to have with one spouse. How did your husband bring that up with you?
John, we had talked about death and dying issues for years, and that's what I really want to encourage people, couples, friends to do with each other. Death for John was not to be feared. Mm-hmm. John had a sense that somehow it's the next step on the journey. He believed that. He talked to me about that years before we had talked with each other. It was no surprise to me when he made the decision he did, which was so bold, so courageous. I'm not sure I would have the courage to go as he did. I want aid in dying for everyone who chooses to go that way.
We are talking with Diane Rehm and Trish Radenberg here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Bill, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. John, I've called into your show before, but this is the first opportunity I've had to talk with Diane Rehm. Before I say what I have to say about both your shows, I'm very pleased to hear what's being done in the way of raising the awareness and trying to get more funding for Alzheimer's and associated brain diseases. My father, dementia, when he passed, and it was discouraging to see what happened to him.
I'm so sorry.
After his, thank you, Diane, after his vibrant life. Diane, I've listened to your show long enough to know how much your husband meant to you. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
I'm glad I have the opportunity to tell you that in person.
Thank you.
The other reason for calling in is just to give allocates to you, Diane, on a national basis, and John, you locally, for having participants on your panels that are knowledgeable and provide adult communication to convey their thoughts and comments on whatever topic is there. It's quite refreshing to hear adults behaving as adults as opposed to being full of hyperbole or whatever.
So, I understand.
Thank you both for your show.
Thank you so much for those comments. And I certainly understand the appreciation for real conversation and opinions that may come from various sides of an issue, but which are delivered with civility and dignity. And I know that that's what you, John, do every day, and I try my very best.
Well, I do it twice a week. You do it every day. My guests are Diane Rehm and Trish Vredenburg. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on Facebook at nolimits@wfyi. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking with Diane Rehm of The Diane Rehm Show and playwright Trish Vredenburg, who has written the play Surviving Grace, which is about coping with Alzheimer's, and will be performed at Clues Hall tomorrow night here in Indianapolis. We're starting to get quite a few questions from listeners, so I'm going to start with an email from Susan, who says, could you ask Diane to say a little bit about how The Diane Rehm Show is produced? Yes, I could, Susan, and I will. Her team must have the best Rolodex in the country. You're dating yourself there, Susan. Rolodexes really aren't used all that much. Her guests are always truly knowledgeable on their topic. How can she pull together great discussions and find guests just a day or so after major news events? How does the team identify topics for the shows that aren't based on current events?
We have 5 full-time producers, 2 part-time producers, and a part-time web producer. It's the smallest team of any nationally produced show in the country. And I feel very, very proud of our team. We meet at 8:15 each morning to decide what is going to be the next day's show. That is, that producer has 24 hours to put together the panel, the questions, the interviews with each of perhaps 20 potential guests before she comes down with the 3 or 4 exactly appropriate people for that show. So I feel so proud to be working with them, and I'm so happy you think that the show is good and that you appreciate the work of those producers. I get the script at about 8:30 the morning of the program. So I'm reading for about 45 minutes and then go into the studio to pre-record the intro and the billboard and that sort of thing. And then we're on the air live. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as soon as I get off the air, I'm thinking about the next day's program. It's as though, you know, I have to wipe the slate clean as soon as I get off the air, because we're already on to the next day's show.
Did it help you that you didn't start out as an on-air person? You were a producer first, right?
Well, I was a volunteer and then became a producer.
But you'd been around the station for, what, a good 5 or 6 years before you were on. You had the show, right?
Exactly. I came in 73 as a volunteer. I became the show's host in 1979.
And it was called Kaleidoscope.
And then by 1984, I went to my boss and said, if we don't do something about this show, I'm out of here. I'm bored. We've got to change it so it's more dynamic, so it's more right on top of the news. So it's just really got to be more immediate. And he went along with me, and we changed the name of the show, and it became The Diane Rehm Show, and it's just gone now from you go off the curb at American University, you go off the air to now more than 2.5 million listeners around the country daily.
Did that changing the title of the show give you any pause at all? Having your name put, because in some ways your focus is on a much larger scale, obviously.
Absolutely.
Similar to this one, the focus is on the guest and on the subject, not on the host.
Of course. But at the time, I believed that, and I think I was correct, that people needed to identify mm-hmm. with a host who they could trust. Mm-hmm. And I gained their trust, I think, by being as straightforward and honest as I could, not only about our subjects, but about myself, my own shortcomings, mm-hmm. my own lack of education, my own lack of background for preparation for the chair in which I sit. So receiving a personal Peabody Award
mm-hmm. Had to feel pretty good.
Oh, my gosh. the likes of which Walter Cronkite, Roger Mudd, Ted Koppel.
That's serious company.
Very few. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm a lucky woman.
We are talking with Diane Rehm and Trish Radenberg here on No Limits. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. We have a listener who's here in the community room at WFYI. Andy, you are on the air. You got a question?
Hi. Go to compassionandchoices.com. Go to usagainstalzheimers.org.
And you'll find there, because it's such a, it affects people so broadly, you'll find also Women Against Alzheimer's. Women are twice as likely to get Alzheimer's as men. African Americans against Alzheimer's are twice as likely as the population. Hispanics against Alzheimer's, clergy against Alzheimer's. You can get involved and you can just sign a petition and you can send to your email list. So it starts to be not just you, but everyone. And just so you know, I mean, there are 200,000 victims of Alzheimer's who are under 65. Early onset, and one of them, we just found out in the autopsy, is Robin Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Robin Williams had not only
Parkinson's,
but also something called Lewy bodies, and I don't know, which is a dementia as well. And I don't even think he knew he had that disease, but it strikes whether you know it or not.
But I'm so glad you asked the question because. Mm-hmm. I think people see the word Alzheimer's or see the word Parkinson's or see the word dementia and turn away. But you're moving toward and you're saying, what can I do? And that's what we hope, that this play and these programs will help people understand the only way we're going to address and ultimately defeat these diseases is for all of us to be involved.
Trish, I'm going to ask, since this is a series of performances and you said the funds are going toward raising Alzheimer's, where are the funds from tomorrow night's performance? Us Against Alzheimer's?
My husband and I pay for the overhead of everyone. You know, so
everything.
Yeah, so none of this is going for, well, you know, office expenses.
Generous of you, thank you.
Well, it's necessary.
Yeah.
I mean, I told my kids, you know, so goes their inheritance. But, you know, anyone can make it on $100 is my feeling.
Yeah.
So, you know, it goes to that. And then it goes to basically getting research money from NIH, from an NIA. So that we can say to them, we can go to Congress and, you know, try and force them to recognize this problem. I tell senators, if you don't want to get Alzheimer's, die young.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want to accept that. And I can't tell you how very few of those senators are accepting.
Is some of it because, by and large, if you've been elected to the Senate, to some level, fortune has smiled on you for much of your life. I mean, you've experienced success. They just feel they're immune from that kind of consequence, or
they. I don't know what it. Well,
yeah.
We tell them it is an equal opportunity disease. You know,
if it's going to hit Robin
and Ronald
Williams,
Reagan,
yeah.
and Robin Williams. It's, you know, so they're not going to get away clean. Some of them say we don't want disease specific. We don't want to name the specific disease. Well, they cannot want disease specific, but you know, you've got to figure out what's going to bankrupt this country, and we're it.
Bob, welcome to the program.
Yes, how are you doing? To you and your guest, I'm very excited about this program and listening to what we have. Well, what I want to say is that, first of all, I would like to say, as far as concerning Diane Reem's show, one is that I love it because of the fact that she does come on the personal level, and she looks at both sides, and I think that is very, very important. And I would like to say that I hope that that same perspective that she comes from, it has an influence in this play that she's in, because I think that in order for someone to see a disease and understand it, you have to have the people that portray, that are playing these parts, really seem authentic. And I say that because a lot of times you have a lot of people that get in certain things just because of the fact that the fame, and of course she doesn't need any, but, you know, and because of the fact that there's a play. And the second thing I want to say is that, you know, a lot of times, you know, understanding, and I understand, you know, raising the money is one thing, but to have that understanding about the disease, because a lot of times what I believe that the greatest thing to overcome any kind of disease is having that love within you to kind of, you know, to kind of hold that person and care for that person, because eventually, you know, I believe that, you know, sometimes they can remember things that, you know, you never thought they would remember.
Thanks for calling. Bob, let me let Trish and Diane respond to that. Thanks very much for the call and the question. Thank you.
I think there is still something inside a victim of Alzheimer's that honestly, there is still a there. And I could see it all the time when my mother, who's at her deepest descent into Alzheimer's, when my husband came to that nursing home, she all of a sudden became a coquette. She was like Scarlett O'Hara, and Rhett had just come in. Me, not so much. But him, she was nuts about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It doesn't, Bob. You don't disappear all of it. And they're proving that with music as well, that music is the last thing to go. And so if you have... They're trying to have iPods for every patient who've been warehoused. They can come alive with music. So.
The other part of Bob's question, what drew the other people besides Diane to performing in the play? Is there that authenticity he was talking about, the sense of connection? Obviously, Diane is Diane.
And
there was a personal connection there, too. You had some experience with it.
But everyone finds that personal connection. Even
That's
Carol
true.
Burnett, who did it in L.A.
Well, you get good people.
We try. let me just say, no Diane Reem. But anyway, even she would just say, well, she didn't know that really many people, but we're all getting older. And she, so yeah. You don't have to be necessarily connected. You just have to know that it's a problem. And there isn't one person who's been in this who hasn't felt that way.
And even in the play, to another one of our caller's points, your mother goes in and out.
Right.
She sees things. She hears things. And yet, in the next minute, she's totally lucid. Mm. So, and that's kind of on the way down,
right.
Isn't it?
Right.
And that's what your mother went through.
It sounds like a combination of observational reporting on your part and, to some degree, stepping into the opening section of Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, you know, where Benji sees things and then they disappear and then they come back and it's everything is present.
We didn't have anyone to analyze Benji's problem. But that's how, you know, it often happens with Alzheimer's, you know, and you get very scared. And I mean, that is what happened with Robin Williams. It's so exacerbated his Parkinson's, which was that he just had nowhere to go. I mean, you can imagine that he couldn't visualize his life as it was to be as it would be.
Gotten an email question from our regular listener, Jerry, who says, this is directed toward Diane. I recall your abortive interview with Henry Kissinger, and he says in parentheses, I thought your questions were eminently reasonable. Would you share thoughts about that interview and how it may have influenced your views about interviewing powerful and influential public figures?
You know, I don't remember the interview with Henry Kissinger as being abortive. He may be thinking of who was the former... it'll come to me, but okay. A leader on the Hill who had promised to stay on for the full hour.
Okay.
And at the 40 break, hung up.
Oh.
Hung up.
That's
and
not good. That's not good in live radio.
Not so good. Absolutely furious. And I think that's what our caller is referring to. And later on, his publicist asked if he might come back on when his next book came out. Yeah. And I said, thank you, but no thanks.
Yeah. We've gotten another email.
Newt Gingrich.
Well, not as much of a surprise.
Newt Gingrich.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Adrian who says, thank you for being such a wonderful and thoughtful presenter, Ms. Rehm. You have interviewed so many interesting people. I'm wondering if you could assemble a panel of three historical figures to interview, who you would choose and what you might ask them.
Tough question.
Yeah. Tough unfortunately, question. We got about a minute and a half to answer.
Okay. I'd put at the top of that list Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And this new information that's come out in a brand new book that he may have been married mm-hmm. and had two children. I want to interview the authors of that book, Eleanor Roosevelt. I'd love to talk with her and Winston Churchill. Those are probably the three.
I can sort of imagine the questions you would ask Jesus, but Eleanor Roosevelt and Winston Churchill.
I would want to know from Eleanor how she managed internally, knowing how deeply affected she was by the realization that not only was her husband unfaithful, which mm-hmm. she knew, but also the struggle she had to put up to have FDR agree to bring those Jews out of Germany when the time came.
We are talking with Diane Rehm and playwright Trish Vredenburg here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking with Diane Rehm of The Diane Rehm Show and playwright Trish Radenberg about her play, Surviving Grace, which will be performed tomorrow night at Clues Hall here in Indianapolis with Diane Rehm in one of the roles. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Becca who says, are there any studies that show what young people can do to delay the onset of Alzheimer's?
Well, they can do what you do for heart and just in general.
Stay healthy.
Well, stay healthy. That would be good. Avoid Alzheimer's. But, you know, exercise, eating right, keeping your mind active. You know, retirement seems to be a good thing, and it is, but your mind has to keep going.
All things John Rehm did.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's not a panacea.
It's not a panacea. I think what happens is that if you're going to get it, you're going to get it. And we don't know.
I don't know. I think you can stave off, certainly with exercise.
I'm eating 2 yogurts a day. That's what they tell us to do.
Yeah. They do?
We've got an email from a listener named Susan, sort of on point. Says, would you please ask Mrs. Rehm if she took advantage of the hospice benefit for patients with Alzheimer's dementia, and if so, did this allow her to keep her husband at home?
No, it did not allow me to keep my husband at home because 5 years prior, we had moved into a condominium, and it did not have sufficient room for him to stay at home, which was why we had to move him to assisted living. But to the first part of her question, we did have the hospice movement involved at the end of his life.
We are talking with Diane Rehm and Trish Radenberg here on No Limits. Marcus, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for this wonderful program, and thank you, Diane and Trish, for participating in this.
Welcome.
I had a quick question. Diane, the world recently lost a treasure with the passing of Dr. Maya Angelou, and shortly after her passing, you rebroadcast the most savory interview with Dr. Angelou, and she alluded to a special kinship with you. And I wonder, from your perspective, if you too saw her as a kindred spirit, and then for Trish as a playwright, were you ever moved by her or her work?
Well, just tell you that at the end of that program, it was so absolutely wonderful because she said, now, Diane, I want to say something to you. And I didn't know what was coming. She said, if you and I lived in the same city, I think you and I would be good friends. I feel a special kinship with you. I think we would have coffee once or twice a week, and we would be good friends. It was such a beautiful moment for me, and I shall never forget her.
Trish.
And as a playwright, as a human being, as an American, as a woman, who wouldn't have that kind of special feeling for Maya Angelou? She was amazing, and we should all be like that.
We've got a listener down in the WFYI community room, Barbara. Mm-hmm. Your question, please.
Diane, we love you so much and wondered if you would mind sharing a little bit about your voice and if you can, we want you to stay on the air forever with us. So if you don't mind sharing a little bit about the voice condition.
Thank you for that question. In 1998, after 6 years of searching what was the matter with my voice, in 1 hour at Johns Hopkins, they diagnosed me with something called spasmodic dysphonia, which begins in the basal ganglia of the brain, which causes the vocal cords to clamp unexpectedly, uncontrollably. In one treatment, they gave me an injection of botulinum toxin, the deadliest poison known to man or woman, directly into my vocal cords, which took out my voice completely for about 2 weeks. All I could do was whisper. So I had to get right next to my husband's ear to talk to him. And he said it was the most intimate time of our marriage. But I now have those treatments probably about once every 5 or 6 months. My doctor at Johns Hopkins has now moved out to Portland, Oregon. So I have to fly out there to get these injections. And I have to be off the air for 10 days or so. And then I'm back for a good 6 months. So thank God, as long as it continues to work, I hope to continue on the air.
What was that? What was that? I mean, obviously, you didn't even, you came to radio already as you were, what, when you started volunteering at the station in your late 30s, right?
37.
If I understand the math, and then you were on the air in your early 40s, so,
right.
And then huge success. And then to find that you've got this challenge to get, what went through your mind?
I thought it was the end, John. I thought, you know, it's the end of my voice. It's the end of my career. And I sat at home for months just totally depressed until our family doctor called my husband and said, we have to get her to Johns Hopkins to find out if she has Parkinson's or ALS or throat cancer or something like that. And they discovered it was spasmodic dysphonia. And so here I am able to continue to talk. There are still breaks in the voice.
Mm-hmm.
My voice is not as beautiful as yours or Trisha's, as you all can talk so smoothly and beautifully. But people seem to have accepted it. I talk more slowly, so taxi drivers around the country say, they all say they learn English from me because I speak so slowly, and that's a blessing.
Does that bother you? Does it bother you at all, though, that that's become sort of linked to part of your story, as it were?
You know, John, it is who I am. Rush mm-hmm. Limbaugh made fun of me on the air the other day mm-hmm. because I speak so slowly, and I was
intelligently, but that's another.
I was in North Carolina, and they played for me. His reference to me and my slow talk, and I thought, well, that's just Rush.
Mm-hmm.
That's who he is and what he does.
If you got him on the show, would you call him on that?
Of course I would, but he would never come on the show. He would never come on the show. I debated him once in my early career. He's not a debater, John.
Mm-hmm.
He's a talker. He doesn't gather his thoughts quickly enough to talk with
mm-hmm.
back and forth in a civil conversation.
Are there guests that raises this? Are there guests that you have wanted to get on the show that you haven't been able to get?
Well, you know, when President Obama awarded me the Humanities Medal at the White House, I went up to the stage. He whispered in my ear. Everybody wants to know what he said to me. He whispered in my ear, Diane, you know, you had me on your show before I became president while I was still senator. And I whispered back in his ear, yes, Mr. President, and it's time for you to come back on again.
Yeah.
And he just burst into laughter.
Do you think you'll get him?
I don't know.
You trying?
Sure.
Yeah. We are talking with Diane Rehm and Trish Vredenburg here on No Limits. Angelique, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Diane, it's an absolute honor to speak with you.
Oh, thank you.
I listen to you pretty much daily, anytime that I can.
Thank you.
My question is regarding families' rights and for patients and their families. And basically, if you have any suggestions or if there are any movements that you're aware of for informing patients of their rights regarding family members who are dying or extremely ill.
What a great question.
My background with this, I work in healthcare. I'm actually a speech-language pathologist. I've worked extensively with brain-injured and stroke patients, so acute rehab, as well as nursing home care. Mm-hmm. So I've seen from the professional end, but I've also had very personal experiences regarding the death of my father.
Oh, I'm so
and
sorry.
Just my experience with that, even being informed of healthcare, was seeing that we were never sort of questioned as long as we were adding interventions. But once my brother and I realized there was really no hope for him to improve, then we started being questioned for whether or not we even had the right to make these decisions for my father. And it was extremely eye-opening. I've considered, you know, even writing a book or something of my experience, because I think about people who aren't, you know, familiar with healthcare. And there's so much, you know, to wade through of what we can do to kind of prepare people for that experience, because inevitably almost everyone will be there at some point in their life.
Yes. Yeah. Angelique, let me let Diane and Trish respond. Thanks very much for the call and for sharing your story.
I would certainly turn to Compassion and Choices for direction there, so that you will have in place not only a living will, but also a durable power of attorney. What you must do, basically, is to talk about these issues before you reach that end stage. Because if you don't, you're going to be faced with those awful questions. You know, even after John had decided he would no longer eat or drink or take medication, the caregivers at assisted living came in and tried to encourage him to drink and tried to present him with menus.
How much of the you know, to pick up on that, on Angelique's theme there, how much of the gatekeeper defender of his choices did you have to play during that
period? Well, thank goodness we had the doctor to say to the entire establishment, Mr. Ream no longer wishes to eat or drink. Do not even come in here with a menu. Do not offer him water. Now, after about 36 to 48 hours, John simply fell asleep and never woke up again, even though he remained alive for that 10-day period. So it no longer became an issue. But she's absolutely right that you must prepare yourself. You must be ready to face those kinds of issues and those kinds of questions.
Yes, and you need to have them in writing.
Exactly.
I mean, that is paramount. We have a very good friend who started with me, Women Against Alzheimer's, Meryl Comer, who has written a play about Slow Dancing with a Stranger, her husband.
A book.
You think plays.
Oh, well,
you think
that's
plays.
Where I go.
Yeah.
It is about, and it's been on the New York Times bestseller list and Washington Post, and it's about her husband who 20 years ago was head of oncology at NIH, and he got Alzheimer's, and she has had him home for 20 years.
Caring for him.
And he is totally gone, but not. And there is no way this man would have wanted that to happen. But there we are in the limbo of this society.
Have we made progress? I mean, I remember earlier in my career when I was a newspaper reporter, there was a colleague at the time whose wife was suffering from Alzheimer's. And for whatever reason, he did not feel comfortable sharing that with anyone. There were all sorts of things that
people hide it.
Yeah,
they're ashamed.
And that's it. He hid her condition. Nobody knew how bad it had gotten.
And for some reason, they fear that it will look bad that they died from that. To what's left of who they were. I mean, even on Ronald Reagan's death certificate, it says pneumonia. Now, pneumonia is an end game of Alzheimer's. You start to not be able to swallow, and then goes into your lungs, and you get pneumonia and die. That's how my mother died. And it says natural causes. The same with Ben Bradley, who had Alzheimer's for years, and that's another thing. Obituaries, we've got to own that. We've got to say why you died so your loved one can have, stand for something that will change what's going on in this society and change from, it's a heroic way to put it in the out. Because if you looked at the obituaries recently, you would think, gee, no one's dying of this. Mm-hmm. But they are. Mm-hmm. And, we just want to open it up.
So we've got a question, Diane, that switches subjects slightly, but it's from a listener who didn't want to go on the air and also mirrors one of mine. And that is, what's it like being on the other end of this process, being the person who has to answer the questions rather than gets to ask them?
I just love talking with people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the reality. My greatest joy is in conversation with people. So it really doesn't matter. You're in control of this program.
Well, one would hope.
And when I'm in my studio, I'm in control, and I can go this way or this way, and I can say, you can talk or you hush or whatever. Here I am blessed just to be in the company of two good people with whom I'm having a conversation. And hopefully people are listening and thinking, gosh, Trish is making such good points about Alzheimer's. We all need to think about these things so much more than we do. It doesn't matter to me which side of the microphone I'm on.
We are just about out of time, but I'd like to say, are there still tickets available for the performance tomorrow?
There are.
And please, where should people go to? Okay, and if people just want to donate, if they've already made their plans for Friday night, where can they do that?
Well, you could even do both, but it's www.usagainstalzheimers.org, and come to our website.
I'd like to thank my guest, Diane Rehm, and Trish Vredenburg. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.